end has heard what I said there. So we now have Peter Clark with us, who is going to talk through with us and discuss with us the topic of long-term investing. And Peter, we've discovered that our agenda over the last day and today, the sort of interaction and long-term investing has come up a few times. So we're all very interested in what you have to say.
Okay, thanks, Joanna, and I hope you haven't exhausted your wish to discuss this topic. There are two papers for you, Agenda Paper 9 and Agenda Paper 9A.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you
Yep.
Before, because I should, sorry, I meant to do this before I did anything else, introduce Sir Callum McCarthy to you, who is one of the trustees who has joined us for this session. He sat in on one of those discussions and will join us for lunch and just after lunch. So I hope you find it interesting, Callum, to see how the Advisory Council works, and we welcome having you join us here. Sorry, Peter.
Thanks. Agenda Paper 9 is a brief summary, which we're going to use as the vehicle for the discussion now. But 9A has got some background information, and I want to take a couple of minutes just to highlight a couple of things in that for you. 9A is actually a paper that the board discussed in September, and it was also discussed at the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum meeting in September as well. So let me pull out a couple of things that I think are of interest in that paper. First of all, the purpose of that discussion was not to take specific standard-setting decisions. So, for example, it wasn't to say whether you should use cost or fair value. The purpose was to see whether the board is going to have the appropriate tools in the conceptual framework as it's being developed to take decisions that take appropriate account of long-term investment issues. The paper deals with two different aspects of that, which are linked but separate. The first question is what to do if the reporting entity itself has some long-term investments. For example, it might have some equities it's holding for the long term, might have some infrastructure assets, things of that kind. And the second question is what if the investors in the reporting entity are themselves long-term investors? What are their information needs? Are they different from other investors? And if so, what does the framework need to say about that? In paragraph 10 of the paper, we make the point that we don't actually try and come up with a definition of long-term investor. And that's partly because of the conclusions we came to. Because we ended up not recommending anything, any specific needs of long-term investment, we didn't feel a need to try and define it. And in fact, we haven't actually found a sort of commonly accepted definition of long-term investment. But fortunately, as I said, we found that we didn't really need one. In paragraph 13, so now I'm on the subject of what if the reporting entity itself has long-term investments. And in paragraph 13, there's a discussion of the business model and business activities. And the board discussed this 2 or 3 months ago and came to the conclusion that the nature of an entity's business activities are going to be relevant in selecting accounting treatments, particularly measurements, but also other things perhaps. And the board decided that the framework would acknowledge this and would contain some discussion of how that might affect various decisions, such as measurement. We came to the conclusion that we didn't want a single overall description of how the business activities might affect every aspect of the financial statements, because we thought that might be different in different parts of the framework. For example, if you're looking at measurement, you might want a distinction between two or three different types of activity. If you're looking at disclosure, you might want a much more granular breakdown. You might want to talk about things like distribution channels or production processes or things of that kind. So there might be more than two or three activities. There might be 20 or 200 different activities. So we didn't think that one size would fit all through the framework. And then the other question was whether we should use the term business model or not. And the board decided not to use the term business model, partly because various other organizations have also used that term and have created definitions of it, and it wouldn't necessarily be the same as definitions we might want for the different parts of the conceptual framework. And in fact, some of our comment letters on the discussion paper did advise us quite strongly not to use the term because of the risk of confusion with other bodies that have used it in different meanings. And so the board's decision was to include in the framework a discussion of how business activities affect decisions measurement, for example, but not to use the term business model to describe that part of the thought process. The paper then touches a bit on the implications for the different areas. There's a discussion in paragraphs 14 to 17 of the implications for measurement. Now, the board is still discussing the measurement chapter. It's been discussing it for the last couple of meetings, and we'll be discussing it again this month. But basically, the way the package is coming together, it's saying that there are various factors to be considered in selecting measurements. There's not a single measurement that's going to work in every case. And the factors to be considered include the nature of the business activities, also include the nature of the asset or liability, includes consistency between assets and liabilities, and some other factors as well. There's also in the paper a summary of the board's tentative decisions so far on the distinction between profit or loss and other comprehensive income. And I won't go through that now, but it's in the paper. And we looked also at whether there was anything specific about long-term investment that we needed to address in other parts of the framework. Overall, the conclusion we came to was that as the framework is shaping up, we think it does give the board the tools it needs to make decisions that will be appropriate. But clearly what those decisions will depend on the circumstances in the light of the framework, of the factors we discuss in the framework. Moving on to the other topic, the implications of, or the information need of long-term investors. That starts at paragraph 21 in the paper. And in paragraph 24, we've provided a summary of what the framework already says, and there are some more extensive extracts from the framework in the appendix. So let me highlight a couple of points from that discussion. In paragraphs 26 to 28, we talk about short-term investors, and there sometimes seems to be an assumption that if we're using current values for some items in financial statements, maybe that's because we're trying to meet the needs of short-term investors. We don't actually think that's right. We think that short-term investors probably aren't necessarily particularly interested in current measurements. So we didn't see that as a particularly strong factor. In paragraphs 29 to 31, there's a discussion of who the primary user group should be. And the framework identifies at the moment potential and existing investors, lenders, and other creditors. And there was some discussion of whether we should narrow that down, either narrowing it down to investors as opposed to lenders and other creditors, or narrowing it down to existing versus potential investors. And the conclusion we came to in paragraph 30 that it wasn't necessary to narrow it down. And in paragraph 31, we've given two or three reasons why we thought it wasn't, in fact, appropriate to narrow it down either. Finally, let me just mention a couple of other things. In paragraphs 32 to 34, we discussed the objectives of financial statements, and we provide a reminder of what the framework says there, that the objective is to give information that's useful to the primary user group for economic decisions. And it's not to encourage or discourage particular types of activity. In paragraphs 35 and 40, we've summarized the board's decision so far on stewardship and prudence, where the board has tentatively decided to make some changes to what the existing framework says about that. And also, after that, we discuss disclosure implications and also the role of financial reporting for dividend decisions. So that's a brief overview of what's in Agenda Paper 9A. Now, we've got three questions that we'd like to discuss with you, and it may make sense, I think, to combine the first couple of questions. The first question is about the objective of financial reporting. Do you agree that the objective is to give information that's useful for economic decisions and not to encourage or discourage particular types of investment or particular types of activity? And then the second question is whether you agree with the conclusion that the board reached, that the tools that are being developed in the framework are going to be appropriate to meet the needs of entities that have long-term investment and of long-term investors in entities, and are there any factors that you consider that we haven't given enough attention to or that we need to consider building into the framework? And so with that, I'll turn it back to you, Joe.
Okay, thanks, Peter. And in just to clarify, the three questions that you've got in your covering memo, they're the three things. So that the end. So it's page 5 of the agenda paper 9 in terms of those questions. And if we can do them one at a time, however, that doesn't necessarily mean that we will, I know that. However, any comments or observations that people have in terms of those? And first of all, and I'm going to pronounce your name wrong, Votchian, isn't it? That's pretty good.
Thank you. I would like to thank you for organizing this discussion. As you know, the European Commission has been very vocal proponent of this discussion. Long-term financing and long-term investing are very important, has been very important for the current Commission, and they will continue to be on the agenda of the incoming Commission. It is generally agreed that long-term financing is of crucial importance for the recovery of the world economy and the stability of financial markets. The topic has featured prominently in discussions in the G20, the OECD, the World Bank, and the Financial Stability Board. In Europe, many EU member states see long-term investing, long-term financing as the priority, and the Commission has been very active in this role. You will probably remember that last year we issued a green paper which tried to stimulate a broad debate about how to foster long-term financing into the European economy. This year, we issued a communication with a set of concrete policy measures. And among the wide range of issues raised, one of our priorities is to examine whether certain aspects in our regulatory framework could disincentivize long-term investors. Financial reporting standards are a key component of that regulatory framework, and we believe that we need to develop a better understanding of their potential effects on long-term investment to avoid any unintended or undesirable consequences. We are therefore very pleased that the ISB decided to consider this issue in the context of its conceptual framework. Some tentative decisions, like the introduction of prudence, were very well received in Europe. And probably many long-term investors would agree that the discussion should continue, should go beyond the conceptual framework project. We are confident as Commission that the ISB is well positioned to respond to this need through research, outreach, and educational initiatives. The Commission looks forward to continue our engagement with the ISB on this very important issue, and obviously I look forward to hearing your views.
Peter, do you want to make any comments in relation to that? Thanks very much for that summary of where the European Commission is at on that. I think that's very important for us and for the ISB to understand. Peter?
Yeah, hi. Can I make a couple of comments that hopefully be helpful, also reply a little bit to what's just been said by the European Commission? I've been managing equity investments since 1981, so I've seen 30 years' history across Europe, not just in the UK. And in that time, the pools available for long-term investment have shrunk. Pension schemes, insurance schemes, used to have tax advantages to them. And they were stable through the 80s. And through time, those fiscal incentives have been taken away. In some cases, you've got quite serious taxation on defined benefit pension schemes being the most obvious example. And so the amount of actual proportion of such funds invested in equities has shrunk dramatically. And also, these pools themselves are largely closed. A lot of insurance funds are in runoff. DB are pretty much in runoff. So my point back to the EU, as I've made to various governments, if you really want to stimulate in long-term investment, you have to do it by stimulating the pools that can invest for long-term, which means some kind of fiscal incentive for people to save for the long-term, hopefully, particularly for pensions. Now, because of the decline in the equity investment, and you look at the initiatives by a lot of governments around the world, what the government's really pushing for long-term investors to invest in is infrastructure. And interestingly, most of that investment will take the place of some form of debt finance or some hybrid vehicle. And I think one of the challenges for the ISAB going forward is that through time, I think you'll get increasing pressure from authorities to invest or to, if you like, do more to encourage debt financing on long-term projects. And we debated this a bit in the investor group, and I think most investors agreed it is not the job of the ISAB to encourage or discourage any particular form of investment. It's to have the environment right so investors can make educated, informed, and accurate decisions. So your question one, I think, is a highly important one in the face of political pressures coming from all over. So I would certainly agree with that. The only thing, if I may, just while I've got the microphone on, disagree a little bit with the executive is in some of the areas about marking to market. If you take, for example, long-term pension schemes or indeed annuity books, which have very, very long duration to its liability there, and you look at the assets that are backing those assets in terms of both duration and indeed maturity are often considerably shorter than the liabilities. And so marking them to market can introduce a lot of distortion into balance sheets and P&L statements, which is not necessarily necessary, because if you've got an asset liability matching situation, I think you've got to think hard about marking to market, because as we all know, markets only trade at fair value twice, once on the way up, once on the way down. And most of the time, they're either systematically overvalued or undervalued. And I think this aspect of accounting has caused a lot of problems for genuine long-term investment pools. So I would encourage areas where specifically there are asset and liability matching situations to look at that in a slightly different way. And I'm not sure I've got all the answers for you, but I would encourage you to inform the thinking on that.
So, Peter, would you hold them at cost?
It partly depends on what you're going to do on the liability side. When you and I last discussed this about 5 years ago, Ian, you're talking about using the risk-free rate for the valuation of the liabilities. You use the risk-free rate for valuation of liabilities, you're going to have a problem if you hold everything at cost. I don't have a right answer for you, but I'm happy to take part in any group that will move towards that.
We didn't get very far with our suggestion of a risk-free rate.
Peter, I'm going to ask you a question now, which is, it's question three on Peter Clark's list. How do you believe, given your experience in the industry, if you like, in terms of that the ISB does most effectively engage with stakeholders and policymakers to help them understand the nature, importance and limitation of the ISB's role?
Okay, I'm going to give you a totally personal view on this. I think the policy makers need to listen more than the ISAB. I think the whole IFS grouping does a pretty good job of consulting. We can always improve on it, and you don't get the level of responses you need, want, and in fact deserve. But there are some issues that policymakers need to actually think a little bit more deeply about in terms of the fiscal incentive to long-term savings. At the end of the day, if you want people to invest, you have to have the savings there. From the perspective of the ISAB and its various groupings engaging with investors, for example, investors are going to do more if they feel they get something out of the meetings and the process. If they get takeaways and they feel as though they've gained something, then they're going to do more. Is if they go along, they say the piece, and that's the kind of last they hear of it, or it's not relevant to them, or they get criticised by the boss for doing it, as you mentioned earlier on, then I think it's a problem. So the more takeaway, if you like, they can take for them and their colleagues, then you're going to get more engagement.
Okay, thank you. A lot of flags have gone up in the last little while, and I've probably got the order wrong, but it was as I looked up. So, Lothar, you're next on my list.
Thank you, yes. Actually, I still have a hard time figuring out or understanding how the financial reporting would influence the long-term or short-term investment, target of investors. I mean, I agree with Peter. If there was a decline of long-term investment and people are asset managers are more short-term, maybe that's true, then it was, I think, for other reasons than financial reporting. And I can see special attention being paid to situations, and again, that agrees with Peter, where asset liability matching is quite clearly demonstrable, and where you maybe not insist on marking to market as much as somewhere else, because these institutions will hold their securities to maturity, for instance. But for the general investor who claims to be a long-term investor, 90% of those long-term investors are not really long-term investors. Maybe I would actually be interested in what the European Commission thinks, if there is some specific thing. What can financial reporting do to incentivize people to be long-term investors? I mean, I think, to me, that's totally different issues which come into play there.
So it's really, you know, what are, and it coming back to, what is that definition, which obviously you did raise at the group this morning. Yeah. Okay, now people have put their cards down as well now, but Charles, I think you're next on my list.
Thank you, Joanna. For the benefit of those who weren't here in the very opening session yesterday when I made some opening remarks, and I'll repeat them and amplify some of them, and I was referring to Australia chairing G20 this year and the work that B20 has been doing, where its principal focus in terms of the recommendations that will be going to the G20 next month are very much orientated to trying to come up with a relatively small set of policies that will stimulate global growth. The flip side of that is that the lack of global growth is perceived to be the single biggest challenge facing the global economy and therefore the political leaders who are represented in G20. A major piece of work consistent with that is looking at infrastructure. And in terms of the work that that particular working party did, they looked at what is the opportunity for substantive infrastructure investment on a global basis, and the numbers they came up with were very substantial. I don't have them at the top of my head, but they're very substantial. They then looked at what is the available pool of capital that might fund that and the likely sources of that capital. And again, they are substantial, but there is still a gap. There would be a gap. However, at the moment, there isn't a significant flow of funds into infrastructure. So the examination then went on to sort of look at the structures and processes that might enable the capital to flow, and there'll be some proposals reflecting in that. As part of the review, there was also an examination of this question as whether or not accounting standards in any way are a roadblock preventing the flow of funds into those long-term infrastructure projects. And that analysis was done essentially looking at each of the sectors that are investors in infrastructure and going through each of them in terms of that question: is, are the accounting standards a potential roadblock? The overall conclusion was no, the accounting standards are not a roadblock. So it's sort of very, I think, reassuring from an IASB point of view. The two observations stroke recommendations that are relevant to accounting standards that came out of that exercise were, one's a little bit sort of esoteric, that we need to look at these projects, these long-term investment opportunities, in a holistic fashion, not just a narrow fashion. And I suspect some of the observations that Peter Chambers is making may actually be linked to that particular issue. And then the second one was suggestion that the insurance standard needs to be completed, given that the insurance sector is potentially, given its long-term liabilities, a potential investor in infrastructure. And in particular, there needed to be an appropriate matching of assets and liabilities in that particular standard. So that's sort of a very high level summary, bearing in mind I've not been a participant in that process but have been privy to a lot of the discussions, partly because a CEO that reports to one of the boards I sit on, in fact he sits on the board as well, has been the chairman of B20, and also there is a body in Australia that is looking very much at the whole issue of integrated reporting, and in one of our meetings we got a very good summary from a couple of senior corporate executives that did participate in a B20 forum that was sort of wrapping up all of the work to give people a high level understanding of what's likely to go to G20. So to me the bottom line is that it's sort of reassuring, or it should be, Peter, reassuring to you that in accounting standards are not a roadblock. They shouldn't be specifically targeting these types of investments, but there's clearly a significant opportunity for major long-term investment projects funded by a variety of sources, including government playing a role, to stimulate global growth.
Thanks, Charles, for that. Isabel?
Thank you. Coming from a standard setter, I can only concur with the conclusion that, you know, accounting standards shouldn't either hinder or incentivise or whatever. However, you know, we do hear issues around, you know, interactions between IFRS 9 and the upcoming IFRS 4. If the ISB, and I can agree with the steps they're taking in the conceptual framework of, you know, reintroducing prudence and stewardship and all those things, are a step in the right direction, then you're sort of sent back down to the standards level. Okay, so we need to look at the standards, and I think I agree with the European Commission's wish to look at standards and seeing whether they do pose a risk, but it's not necessarily only for long-term investors. I mean, some standards could possibly pose a risk for short-term investors. So it's not just looking, it's sort of taking a holistic look of, you know, what the impacts may be. So if I come back to the perception that, for instance, there may be, you know, a bias, how are you going to resolve that? Where are we going to see in the IFRS literature that you're not trying to promote or not promote either? So I was wondering whether in the paragraph where you talk about capital providers and creditors, which is not very developed in terms of who these are, you could make a reference maybe not to long-term investors per se, because they may be hard to define, but to the detention horizon, and say that, you know, regardless of their objectives in terms of why they detain this, you know, it should and then all the rest of the conceptual framework with faithful representation and stewardship and everything, sort of it all clicks in, but sort of maybe expands that paragraph so that you make sure that, you know, the objective is not to have a bias.
There's probably a question rather than a comment, but is that something that we should pick up in the framework, or is that something that's best dealt with at the standards level? I mean, the way I was seeing it at the moment, we've got some fairly general material in the standards. When we get down to the standards level, then the board will need to satisfy itself, for example, which measurement is going to give the most relevant information to the users. The framework will provide some basic tools for the board to think about when it's using that, but it's not going to provide it with the answers. So I guess the question that most directly interests me in terms of running this project is there more we could or should put in the framework at this stage?
Well, if you link it back to other issues around who the hypothetical user is, I think it needs to be in the framework.
Certainly something, Peter, just for you to think about as to where, I mean, the expansion idea of emphasising there is no bias, somewhere anyway. Yeah. Good point. Thanks, Isabel. Egbert.
Thank you, Joanna. My comment is actually underlining and extending a bit the comments that Charles made. the report you refer to around the question of whether current accounting standards are a roadblock, I think it was shown on day one. It's unlocking investment in infrastructure. I think it's the same report. It was put out by the six accounting firms, and it addresses the question of whether current accounting and reporting is a barrier to this. And I'm not going to repeat what Charles said. He referred to it correctly. I would only add that it also includes a couple of comments on the wider area of corporate reporting and that initiatives in that area could bring about a better reflection of the risk and performances around longer-term infrastructural projects. And it also includes some recommendations for prudential regulation as it relates to, for example, risk charges in calculations. So extending on those comments and sort of confirming the sort of the middle recommendation around the accounting standards not being a roadblock.
Thanks, Egbert. Julie.
Thank you. To me, this is kind of a classic IASB conundrum where you have some jurisdictions where the regulatory regime or the governing regime views accounting standards as a legitimate tool for incenting certain activities. And you have other constituents where the governing or regulatory regime views accounting standards as out of bounds for incenting. Rather, accounting standards are for informing investors, but not for, you know, incenting a particular behavior. So I certainly can hear some comments of, you know, enthusiasm for looking forward to the ISB considering the role in incenting. But I would have to say from my own country, there's equal enthusiasm for the ISB not looking at using IFRS for incenting behaviors, just given the environment and the way our system is structured.
Thanks, Julie, for those comments. Zinger.
So what I wanted to say on this issue is really just with respect to the whole issue of when you look at the role of the IASB, I think it's very important, which I think other colleagues have said, it's really not to have a bias towards any one thing. I think it's very important for the IASB to be seen as being a neutral party and really at the end of the day trying to foster transparency. So really looking at focusing on how do we provide information in a way that people are able to make informed decisions as opposed to trying to incentivize them to take any one particular position. I think that is the safe road and a more credible road for the ISB to take. But in terms of a role, I think the role should be seen as one of fostering transparency. So irrespective of what other groups may you know want from it, it's really about ensuring that everyone, irrespective of who the user is, has the appropriate level of information to be able to make a good decision.
Stephen?
Yeah, I suppose just really by way of information and also to Charles's point on the B20 initiative, I'm currently working with the Asia Pacific Financial Forum, who are specifically looking at the issue of cross-border debt issues, particularly for the infrastructure in the Asia Pacific region. And one of the work groups I'm chairing is actually on the disclosures in those debt instruments. And we're only, I suppose, at the moment at the what I would call the looking at best practice and also expectations. But in doing so, we feel we're identifying issues that possibly could be best placed in additional disclosures from the standards. A lot of it would probably be regulatory. There's things that are probably non-GAAP and also credit rating issues and various things. But I think as a product of that, it might be worth me feeding back directly the findings there. The report will go to the finance ministers in the Asia Pacific region, and the idea is that they will then use that either to push regulation or to try and promote the change to the standards. So I will try and feedback to Peter the findings as we go through that process.
I think that would be very useful. Thank you, Stephen. Goro.
Okay. Thank you, Joanna. That the first of all, I'd like to express my sincere respect to long-term investment and also long-term growth. But at the same time, I'd like to share with you my experience in Japanese banking crisis. I used to be a banking analyst at the midst of the Japanese banking crisis. We used to have a very, cost basis accounting. We had no, fair value or mark-to-market accounting at the midst of the banking crisis, which covered that the reality of the Japanese banking situation, which rather delay to bring the solution to this, to the banking crisis. As a result, what happened? We had a very stable profit and the shareholders' value, equity of the banks to some point, but this rather delayed the solution. As a result, as you know, Japan is suffering from the long-term, very low growth. So this experience led me to believe what accounting standards can do is that the faithful representation of the economic reality. I don't believe that IASB to encourage or discourage that the particular type of investment. And so I think that our Japan's, very severe lesson should be taken care of for this particular discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think I'm hearing out of that an advocate for fair value accounting. And Ian's smiling.
Excuse me. I forgot to. Yeah. In that regard, I share with you, but at the same time, I share with to some extent Peter's point that regarding pension, that regarding the scope of the fair value accounting application, I think we should be very prudent. What kind of measurement basis would be the best to represent that the economic reality of that all these systems? Thank you.
Thanks, Goro. Anne?
Yes, I'd like to bring to the table my experience. I sit on the OECD, and I work with them on their investment committee and on their corporate governance committee, particularly from the perspective of business. Now, if you know the OECD structure, it's all the governments around the table and three others, the World Bank, the trade unions, and business. So in these two committees where I go along to represent business, I have heard for the past 3 years the pressure from governments to fund jobs and growth, jobs and growth, jobs, environment and growth. I do not believe it is the role of the accounting standard setter to take part in those political economic manipulations, just whatever you like to call it. We, from the investor perspective, we want accounting standards to be as neutral as possible, to not encourage in any way, shape or form pro-cyclicality, whether it be to increase jobs or growth or vice versa, or to top it down a little bit, or to manage inflation. We want to see that there is as few incentives as possible to behaviours in the accounting standards, either for incentives into a particular investment or for an action for a particular course of action. I think if you want to have a look at all that other movement towards growth, towards jobs, you need to actually have regulators do that or governments do that. But I don't believe that's the role of an accounting standard setter, and I would be alarmed if we would consider it in that vein.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. I think that's it. Yeah, as Charles just whispered to me, a pretty strong message. Yep. Linda.
I guess being a member of the insurance industry, it might be appropriate to talk a little bit about long-term investing, as we're probably some of the long-term investors in the global world. And as part of that, I think we have seen accounting standards impact long-term investing in various parts of the world, where they have gone to a risk-free or something else and shortened the duration of their liabilities and changed their asset mix. I want to point out, I do agree in full transparency. I do agree with fair value accounting, and I do agree with disclosures. What we're really more interested in is making sure that the short-term market noise doesn't, that where we believe we're asset liability match, doesn't overwhelm the financial statements of the insurers to such a point where you're going to incent us, or markets will incent us, not to invest long-term and to shorten the duration of our products. We're seeing that throughout the world in various forms, whether it's regulators or other areas that are putting pressures there. So I think just keep in mind transparency, full disclosure, but not to overwhelm our statements with short-term volatility that really masks the long-term asset liability matching and risks in the industry. Right. I think those are the discussions that we're trying to get through.
Thanks, Linda. Mary.
I think it was probably about 15 months ago, I participated in an FSB workshop on long-term investing. One of the strongest messages I heard out of that, I haven't heard cited today, so just wanted to throw it out and flag the potential implications for the ISB. Probably the single strongest message was there is currently an environment, again, 15, 18 months ago, that was a disincentive for long-term investing that arose from regulatory uncertainty. And the single strongest message I heard was greater regulatory certainty would promote, help remove some of the barriers to making long-term commitments. Because if you weren't certain, let's say, what capital charges would be, or what liquidity charges would be, that was a disincentive to making a commitment to pricing today. And I think if I try and translate that into what's the message for the ISB, I think it's let's look at how we take on and manage, especially our most significant projects, in terms of delivering not only transparency in the product, but also transparency, along the process, and trying to manage that to be as efficient as possible in terms of the time spans of projects. I don't think, to Peter's questions, I don't think any of that goes into the conceptual framework, but I think it's more a process and organizational reminder for us rather than a conceptual framework type of thing.
Thanks, Mary. Begonia?
Well, thank you. Well, I just want to strongly support previous comments that express the view that the ISB should not be engaged in trying to promote one particular type of investment or any other effect. Well, I think that the objective of achieving transparency in the financial statements in order to facilitate the economic decisions, and particularly of those that don't have access to private information, this will be the best way to achieve a better functioning of better efficiency of the capital market. So my idea, my advice is to maintain a strongly firm commitment to have transparency, and that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Begonia. I think that's a clear message that's coming through from a very large number of people. Mariko.
Thank you, Chairman. I have just a comment. I think it is very important to consider how to promote long-term investment, because that contributes to economic growth, and Japan is one of the G20 countries. But on the other hand, my concern is accounting should not be influenced by any specific policies. And I understand that each jurisdiction has their own policies, but accounting is a tool to reflect the financial activities and accounting itself should not be a tool to promote or give any disincentive for any specific policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariko. Linda, have you put yours back up again?
I just wanted to add something to what Mary said about certainty and regulation. And I think that is one of the things that some of the insurance geographies, Europe's got solvency too, but in many of our other jurisdictions, regulation does follow some accounting. And it would be very hard for the regulators to put in something that would be less conservative or more conservative than an accounting standard. So accounting does impact regulation as we may not want it to, but in reality it does. So they're linked, and we need to make sure that we haven't gone overboard on that.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And Wojciech, you had the first word, and I think I'm going to give you the last word.
thank you very much. I think that maybe I would like to clarify our position, because I think it's not properly understood, and that may create tension or be problematic. The Commission does not think that does not want to encourage or discourage any type of behavior. It's not that we have any preconceived ideas, or we think that we have a list of things that need to be changed in some standards, and then it will improve the lot of long-term investors. Not at all. We think that this is accounting is just an element in a bigger picture. We approach it as the whole regulatory framework, and we want to analyze it, how it is designed, whether some aspects of it simply create unintended or undesirable consequences. So it's not that it's not about fair value, it's not about other things that were mentioned here. And our aim is just to raise the issue, because we think it is a valid a valid point, and we are relaying to you what we heard through our consultation last year on our green paper, which was to stimulate the debate, and we heard many voices saying that in fact it is worth pursuing further discussion. So we're getting there. Thank you very much for all your comments.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And I think, Peter, I'm going to try, and you've obviously noted down a number of things, and as Alan did by producing 10 slides this morning on the materiality when I summed up in about 2 lines, I'm going to do 2 lines now, but hopefully you've got a lot more out of it than that. But certainly what I got out of the discussion was a very firm advice that accounting standards should be neutral, and that it's the role of the regulators more in terms of incentivizing or not, and that the focus of the accounting standards should very much be fostering the transparency and to enable the informed decision making. However, maybe there is something that we can do, in terms of your the actual framework, about emphasising that as much as anything else, that it is the neutrality that is the important thing. There are issues around, obviously, then the actual accounting in terms of the matching, the volatility, around that, and certainly the B20 report in terms of the accounting standards are not currently a hindrance. So I think the accounting standards should stay neutral, and they're not currently a hindrance is probably the two key messages from what this group is what I've taken out of what this group is saying, in terms of which I think is probably consistent with what you're getting elsewhere and where the board ended up with. So Peter, I'm going to give you the last word if you'd like to say anything before we break for lunch.
Yeah, that's basically how I was going to summarize it as well. And I think it's actually reasonably consistent with what we heard at the ASAF meeting as well last month, which is also encouraging.
Okay, on that note, that was two lines, all right. On that note, I will say thank you very much, Peter, and thank you to everybody for very great contributions. It is always good to have those contributions. We will now break for lunch. We are due back at 1:15. I'm going to suggest again that we do come back at 1:15 for the feedback on the risks and opportunities. So enjoy your lunch. And think about the opportunities, remember, because I'm going to ask you.